Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Todd is God, the authorized story of how I created Extreme Championship Wrestling, by Todd Gordon and Sean Oliver. Foreword by Terry Funk. Narrated by Sean Oliver. For Adrian, my forever partner. Foreword. ECW certainly made its mark. It was a necessary thing for the athletes in the business at that time. They needed a place to establish themselves, create themselves. And that's what ECW was. It was a very creative place. I was attracted to ECW because of the challenge. I was bound and determined that we would not fail as a group of individuals. It was a challenge for us, and for Todd Gordon, too. It was a rough row to hoe, but I stuck with them, and would like to think I gave them a rub, as it was my intention to do so, while also putting a little scratch on Vince McMahon's arm. I did whatever I could to agitate that asshole up north. I was very proud of all the people in ECW. They wanted to do something, to be part of something, and Vince damn sure wasn't going to let them in WWE. They had one choice, so I gave myself one choice also, to help make ECW. Eventually, Vince got a whiff of ECW, and he didn't like it at all. We went in other directions, and he had no choice but to accept us as a pain in the ass. I look back at my time in ECW fondly. It was a marvelous time, and Todd was the one who stepped out onto that diving board and jumped right into the deep end. The one guy who could compete with Vince McMahon. Terry Funk, 9-time Hall of Famer and multi-time World Heavyweight Champion, July 2022. Introduction. I was warned. It happened at the Philadelphia Airport Marriott in 1993, just before the explosive grassroots surge in popularity of my independent wrestling company. I had no idea I'd be meeting the World Heavyweight Champion when I woke up that day. In the early 90s, Ric Flair was the most recognizable name in wrestling, maybe second only to fellow bleached blonde megastar Hulk Hogan. Flair had held world titles more than 10 times by then, having worked in a pro wrestling ring with just about every living legend of the sport. He'd toured the globe as the NWA World Champion, facing top talent in every promotion under the sun, and was a top draw himself. This was at a time when world titles were reserved for the few elite wrestlers who could represent the business well and do huge box office. In all ways, Ric Flair represented the legitimate pro wrestling world. I, in sharp contrast to Ric Flair in every way, was barely in the business. I did own a wrestling federation, though that by itself is not sufficient grounds to share space with Flair. Independent wrestling companies had popped up all over the country, each run with varying degrees of competency and professionalism. That's putting it mildly. Most were a shit show. Eastern Championship Wrestling, the company I'd recently started, was, at its heart, a regional independent promotion. But we began to pull away from the pack, garnering television coverage on Sports Channel Philadelphia and eventually Sports Channel America, and popping up on all strange ends of the TV dial, literally. Remember UHF? It was for stuff like this, and Bulgarian cooking shows. If you made it through Anastasia baking strudel at midnight, you could catch Johnny Hotbody battling Jimmy Snuka at 1 in the morning. Having TV distribution, any TV at all, is the single most important ingredient in keeping a wrestling federation afloat. The boys, wrestling parlance for the talent, also called workers, were far more willing to stay loyal to a company giving them televised exposure. It added an element of cachet to both the product and the individual workers in the ring. From the promoter's standpoint, it allowed wrestling storylines to continue on a weekly basis. You could draw out more intricate feuds over time, advancing the intrigue weekly, as opposed to having to tie everything up with a neat bow on top by the end of each monthly show. Television was what distinguished a wrestling promotion from a gaggle of day workers flipping each other in VFW halls before the locals. As limited as our broadcasts may have been, we had TV, baby. You could count the number of promotions that could say that in 1993 on one hand. On this particular day, I was invited to lunch with Kevin Sullivan and his wife, Nancy. They were both ring veterans who'd come to do some shots for my company, Eastern Championship Wrestling. I knew Kevin couldn't stay. He was headed back to World Championship Wrestling, WCW, one of the two remaining major national federations at the time, and would eventually be given a spot on their booking team. Bookers are the writers and decision makers for wrestling shows. They're a crucial part of any wrestling company's office, as they make decisions like who wins, loses, and becomes champion. But they're even more important for big-time televised companies because they control everything that airs on the shows. In addition to fan reactions, TV ratings are their real barometer. It's a big job. Besides being known as a booker, the short and stocky Sullivan was also a high-profile wrestler. He'd perfected an evil in-ring persona, conjuring references to the occult and black magic, with the statuesque and stunning Nancy at his side, playing a character simply known as Woman. They'd done some work for me, and before heading back to WCW, Kevin asked me to have a bite with them at the Marriott. I was only too happy to oblige. Despite my owning ECW, there was still a wrestling fan living inside me. I was open to picking Sullivan's brain, as the future direction of my company was a tad unclear. I'd recently lost my booker, Eddie Gilbert, for reasons I'll go into later, and I'd just asked his friend Paul Heyman to stay on board and help me with the creative decisions. Heyman, known to all as Paul E., in reference to his WCW persona as manager Paul E. Dangerously, was a talented young man. He was great on the microphone, with a wit so sharp and an inherent knowledge of the business and how it all worked. The talent seemed to like him, and, more importantly, I was finding we had a lot in common. For starters, Paul was a fellow Jew. His mother, Sulamita, was a Holocaust survivor at Auschwitz, a fact that endeared her to my own mother when she came to know her. We had identical senses of humor, likely fostered by similar ethnic big-city upbringings, me in Philly, and Paul in New York. Well, Scarsdale, but close enough. I didn't know him that well at the time, but he'd offered to help me out in Eddie's absence and was doing a great job at his primary duty, keeping talent away from me so I could run the company. Paul and I started sharing creative ideas, and soon enough we were seen as the 1-2 punch in Philly's fledgling, independent alternative to the sleepy WWE and moribund WCW. We were soon making waves, building a reputation among veteran world-famous talent and getting some ink in the wrestling newsletters, known in the locker rooms as the Dirt Sheets. Kevin Sullivan no doubt saw the potential in ECW, and I suspected that's what this lunch was about. Wrestlers are opportunists, creatures wired to position themselves for survival in an unfriendly and perilous habitat. I knew my company was different from the others, and I knew Kevin knew it too. I entered the Marriott at the appointed time and sat with Kevin and Nancy for lunch. After a few minutes of conversation, I saw Nature Boy Ric Flair step off the lobby elevator and head toward our table. This was historic. Prior to my starting Eastern Championship Wrestling, I would have only been able to meet Ric Flair as a fan, but now I was here to dine with Kevin Sullivan, a major creative player for the very federation Flair sat atop. I'd hopefully be introduced as a company owner, and there was a chance Flair had even heard of us. Maybe he'd even seen the product after closing the bars last night and turning on the hotel TV at 4 a.m. Perhaps he was flipping around the deep channels hoping for free porn and instead found Don Morocco winning our heavyweight title. Flair's blonde locks bounced as he strutted across the lobby, enrapturing all in his sphere. Ric Flair had that effect on a room. Hell, an arena. "Hey, devil," Flair called as he approached our table. It was the first and only time I'd heard Kevin referred to as such. The world champion got to our table, and the first thing Kevin did was make the introduction. "Ric, this is Todd Garden," he said. "I told you about ECW. Before I could extend my hand and begin talks about why Ric Flair needed to add the Eastern Championship Wrestling heavyweight title to his list of belts, he looked down at me. "Brother," Ric Flair started, Your piece-of-shit partner, Paul, is a fucking pathological liar. I was too flabbergasted to protest that Paul wasn't really a partner. It was my company, and he was helping me book. I wasn't even paying him. He just showed up with his friend Eddie Gilbert one night and kept coming down to shows, even after Eddie was gone. I didn't know what had happened between Rick and Paul. They obviously knew each other while working at WCW together, but the source of this heat was unknown to me. This was Rick fucking Flair, royalty in the business, and he'd just officially given the thumbs-down vote on my new choice of booker. What the hell did he know? Chapter 1. Business. Don't cheat anybody. Don't lie. This was the only explicit business advice my father, Charles Gordon, ever gave me. It was a serious business we were in, taking responsibility for someone's jewelry and lending them money against it. And if you were not ethical and word got out, your whole business was shot. It was all about integrity. That's probably true of any industry, but pawnbroking in particular is a business of relationships. You had to foster strong ties with your community of potential customers, especially if you were running one of Philadelphia's institutions, which we were. Carver W. Reed was a company started in 1860 by Carver Reed himself. My grandfather established a retail jewelry store on Philadelphia's Jewelers Row in 1902 called Harry Gordon and Sons that he ran with his three sons, my dad and two uncles. He bought Carver W. Reed in 1949 and increased his portfolio to two locations. When he died in 1968, the two stores were split between the sons, with my uncles getting Harry Gordon and Sons and my dad getting Carver W. Reed. The Philly institution landed in my family's control, where it remains to this day. By 1970, I was working there through my summers beside my dad. My sisters, Nancy, Beth, and Leslie, had no interest in working at the store, so it was always Dad and me running the place, along with around 10 workers. My father was a master craftsman, a gifted jeweler with a killer work ethic and a reputation for honesty. He was the classic gentleman of a bygone era. He wore a suit and tie until the moment he got home, wherein he'd slip into his smoking jacket and the damn tie would stay knotted beneath until he was ready for bed. He might have slept in it for all I knew. I was a teenager without a care or a damn plan in the world. The shop was a place for me to kill time and hang out during the summers without any real responsibility. I could call in sick when I wanted without repercussion. It didn't matter to me. I saw no future there. There were almost a dozen employees making their entire living through the shop, but for me, it was mainly a place to make $100 a week for pot money. Carver W. Reed's legacy was very important to my father. That was something he drilled into my head not so subtly as decades passed, and I eventually told him I was starting a wrestling company. He saw my involvement in pro wrestling as nothing more than a pastime, which, quite frankly, I did too when I started. He would constantly remind me Carver W. Reed was my bread and butter. It must have resonated because throughout my tenure running ECW, I never stopped working full-time at the store. There was a part of me that hoped my father would see ECW as a success story, my starting a business from nothing and growing it into a powerhouse. He didn't understand any of it. ECW, the business, or wrestling in general. He would say it was like roller derby, and truth be told, it kinda was. I loved it, but I understood it was an acquired taste. Pop was a serious guy, a hardened businessman, so watching Wild Samoan Afa ball-shot Dominic DiNucci was understandably beyond his purview. "That's not real salt they're throwing," he would say to me as Mr. Fuji blinded some poor schmuck in the ring. I tried to argue, but he wasn't hearing it. He'd shake his head and ask me when I was going to outgrow that wrestling crap. It was a question he started asking me when I was 9 years old and continued for quite some time afterward. To be exact, all throughout ECW. No one in my family ever saw ECW, even though it was on TV weekly. But later on, when ECW was at its height, my dad began to tell people about it. "My son," he'd brag, "he has a wrestling business." The Federation's success and press coverage suddenly justified the pursuit. But did Charles Gordon ever watch the thing? Never. Did he turn on the damn TV and watch one match, one promo? Not even once. Maybe it was better that way. Ball shots were the least of what we did in ECW. My father definitely would have thought my lying bloodied in the ring or arranging catfights between scantily clad valets violated his singular commandment, "Don't you let that wrestling crap kill Carver W. Reed's legacy." In all fairness, though, Mr. Reed never saw Francine's tits. I think he would have loved ECFNW. I was a wild kid. Not bad, per se. I didn't start fires or strangle field mice. I was just undisciplined. I no doubt had ADHD, but nobody had heard of that in 1962. My teachers would excuse me from class when I got too disruptive and make me run laps in the courtyard until I couldn't breathe. I'll repeat that for anyone who isn't now wondering what exactly the state of Pennsylvania required of one applying for licensure as an educator, beyond a pulse. My teachers would send a misbehaving, uncontrollable 6-year-old outside, alone, in the cold, to run in circles until his tongue was wagging out of his mouth. I guess I'm being too critical. It actually worked. When I returned and sat down to thaw, I was too tired to act up. In truth, my behavioral issues really amounted to an early display of leadership skills. That's how I saw it, anyway. I was kicked out of the carpool in first grade when I convinced all the other kids to punch Bonnie Wright in the stomach. True to society's mistreatment of leaders, I was the one punished, and I hadn't even touched the girl. My mom was less than thrilled, as she now had to drop me off and pick me up every day. But if you want to call that a behavioral problem, so be it. I tried to convince my mom it was leadership. I lasted until third grade, and then I was off to private school. Everyone had lost patience with me, and my parents hoped this would be a remedy. I can't say that I actually heard Drexel Hill Elementary School administrators celebrating when I was walked out the door for the last time, but I swear I heard champagne corks pop behind me. My sisters seemed to escape such corporal punishment, but that didn't make them any holier. Leslie, the younger of the two and my senior by 4 years, was usually my partner in crime. She remained so through adulthood, as evidenced by the rearrangement of seating plans at family functions. Even into our 60s, everyone knew if Todd and Leslie were seated beside each other, it was only a matter of time before the giggles would begin, soon devolving into outright cackles and guffaws. We had the same irreverent sense of humor that was often appreciated by us alone. God bless her, Leslie was my evil twin. Nancy Beth and Leslie couldn't have been more opposite. Nancy Beth was a reader, more of a loner like Dad. On your average day, if Nancy Beth was sitting at the table with a book, Leslie and I were choking ourselves with laughter while trying to make milk come out of our noses. Sophisticated humor was our specialty. Around this time, I saw pro wrestling on TV for the first time. We got the WWWF product in Philly. This was the era of wrestling territories, and cable TV had not yet entered our lives. In fact, having never even seen a wrestling magazine, I didn't know wrestling existed outside Philadelphia. It would be many years before TBS would carry Jim Crockett's Mid-Atlantic shows and ESPN would send Vern Gagne's American Wrestling Association into our homes. Back then in Philadelphia, it was all Bruno Sammartino all the time, baby. Throw in a little Bulldog Brower, Killer Kowalski, and the Graham Brothers, and you'd have the recipe that got me hooked. Look at those names I mentioned. Brower, Kowalski, and the Grahams. What characters? That's the very thing I was most attracted to in wrestling. Characters. Guys who could grab the mic and cut a captivating promo. The guys I hung out with years later in ECW were unique personalities, like Sandman and Johnny Grunge. They were extreme characters, no pun intended. They were so different from me, and I was fascinated by that lifestyle on the edge, that shirking of responsibilities life thrusts on most people. I was jealous of guys that could disappear for days at a time without consequence. I couldn't understand how they lived that way. It was a stark contrast to my regimented life running Carver W. Reed and my responsibilities at home. I always wanted to know what that felt like. I got one vacation a year. These guys were on vacation all year long. I realized early on that wrestling was built on characters. Without it, storylines didn't mean anything. Fans wouldn't care, and talent would forever be interchangeable. Paulie and I would meet new talent and try to find the authentic character living inside them. That's exactly the reason I fought Paul to allow Sandman to come to the ring with a cigarette and a beer, but more on that later. I was alone with my love of pro wrestling in my childhood home. The only family member who enjoyed watching wrestling was my grandfather on my mother's side. I showed it to him, and he got such a kick out of it, he would leave the TV tuned to UHF Channel 17, where it aired on Saturdays. He was afraid he wouldn't be able to find it again, and he'd bark at my grandmother in his charming Romanian-Yiddish mix if she tried to change the channel. To him, every blow in the ring was real. My prankster expertise no doubt developed due to him. At some point in the 1970s, when he was about 75 years old, my grandfather was headed to a doctor's appointment without a ride, so he hitchhiked on City Avenue and snagged a ride from some dude in a sports car. Upon being dropped off at the doctor's, he turned to his ride and said in his thick accent, "Thank you. I'll be out in about an hour." The guy was dumbfounded and began to protest when my grandfather began yelling at him until he sped away. My grandfather would throw his head back and howl in his guttural guffaw. He was always up to some shenanigans, even at home, when that old rascal would chase my grandmother around the dining room table, grabbing at her boobs in front of me and my friends. We thought it was funny as hell, and that was all the encouragement he needed. That was my guy, Grandpop. He'd slide me pickles under the table throughout family dinners after my father barked I was ruining my appetite eating too many of them. He was great. I laughed all the time around him. My father was not outwardly funny, but he would occasionally do something more low-key, like changing table numbers on his friend's seating cards when he was checking in at a wedding. I eventually used that one myself. I love to see the reactions on people's faces. Even now I do shit like that. I was in the doctor's office recently for an epidural in my back when the nurse told me, "Lie on your stomach." I lay down and said, "I was really tall in high school. I married a movie star. I had blonde hair." I kept going until the doctor figured out what I was doing and laughed. That crass nurse didn't crack a smile and is still probably trying to figure it out as I write this. I'm definitely a cross-section of Grandpop and my dad. I graduated without incident and went to Pitt, where I majored in psychology, business, and drug use, pushing myself further from a pursuit in something creative. Word on the street said psychology was the easiest degree to get. It was really just knowing people, and I had an innate sense of that. My only experimentation with illicit substances to that point had been some pot in high school, which, for the 70s, might as well have been chocolate milk. College was different. There was shit available to me all over the campus. They say the 70s were all sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and I can confirm it was indeed the best era to be a teenager. Women were experimenting with a newfound freedom, and much of it was sexual. There was no AIDS, but plenty of burning bras. I tried my hand at acting, doing some shows at the college theater in an effort to scratch that itch. One semester, I loaded my schedule with acting and creative writing classes. I got a 4.0, my highest GPA ever, by at least a 3-point margin. Doing those shows and taking the acting classes satiated my hunger for a creative outlet, but as soon as they were over, it was back to the doldrums. Then, quite by accident, I got a unique opportunity to exercise some creative muscle. One night, while out at a local watering hole, my friend Pete Theodorus and I started yucking it up with some older guys who were starting a comedy magazine called Rag. They pitched the idea as a National Lampoon magazine for sports. They planned to write parody articles about real-world pro athletes and sports teams, like a fictional, sarcastic Sports Illustrated. I was all in. This fit me perfectly. I loved sports as much as I loved sarcasm. We jumped in and got working on issue number one, featuring the cover story, Women in Sports. Our tasteful first cover was a woman sitting on a bench in a locker room wearing a baseball uniform beside a bloody tampon. Yeah, it lasted one edition. Though Pete Theodorus had no comedy writing work on the horizon for me, he did throw a job offer my way. His father had a pipe painting business in Cleveland, and it seemed he was looking for workers to put on the payroll at $500 a week. That was nothing to sneeze at for a 22-year-old in 1977, added to the fact that I still had absolutely no plans after graduation. It sounded like $1 million to me. Pipe painting? Sounded fun. I ran it by my father, who wisely shot holes in it. He was thinking long-term, whereas I was thinking about the next paycheck. He made the tired old pitch again. Work at Carver W. Reed. He went through the litany of old person things that reinforced responsibility, a future, and a way to put food on my table. It was like nails on a chalkboard. Worse, it was like Shane Douglas's nails on a chalkboard while dressed in his Dean Douglas gimmick. Oof. Dad reminded me that I had free parking at the shop. I'd have health insurance provided for me, and nothing offered quite as much job security as a family business. He asked me to try out Carver Reed again, and, without an argument left in me, I capitulated. Unwittingly, I just moved myself into owning the first of two businesses in my life. When I decided that Carver Reed was to be my future, I grabbed it with both hands and never let go. I was now a college graduate, full of piss and vinegar, and convinced I knew more than anyone in the world. Never mind that I'd be proven wrong again and again, as I learned from my dad by being at his side. I brought personality to the job, and in time, I was building rapport with customers. They could go anywhere and pawn that diamond ring, but I made sure they knew they could trust us being responsible with their valuables. It also helps to be able to tell a customer you've been in business 120 years, now 160. Customers had a friend in Carver W. Reed. The most poignant thing that came from my decision to commit to Carver Reed was the strengthening of my bond with my dad. He became my best friend in the most organic way possible, working with each other and relying on each other. He taught me all aspects of the business. Then, in 1985, my father underwent quintuple bypass surgery, largely putting him out of action from that point forward. I took the business on my shoulders and ran with it. He'd prepared me perfectly in the 10 years prior, and the transition felt seamless. His old-time business connections already knew and liked me. It was easy to pick up and move ahead with the company. I was comfortable accepting his contemporaries as my own. I also found myself to be a natural manager, as first displayed in the carpool offensive against Bonnie Wright, a skill that would come in rather handy when, in a few years, I would be dealing with a crop of workers slightly more challenging than pawnbrokers. I was equally comfortable talking with people from any walk of life, whether having martinis with heads of business or smoking a doobie with a wrestler at a backstage door. In short time, I was made president of the Pennsylvania Pawnbrokers Association, and I'd go on to become president of the international charity, the Variety Club. I soon felt I couldn't join anything without becoming president. I was firing on all cylinders and managed to make Carver W. Reed more successful than I'd ever imagined possible. My personal life was in order, too, and I was able to provide long-standing stability and security for my family while preserving the long legacy my father and grandfather had established. I was, by all accounts, a success. But one fact remained. Carver Reed was killing my creative side. Someone listening to this might intone that I should have shut up and been happy. It's a hard thing to understand unless you have that creative bent inside you. The impulse to create isn't attached to a switch or a schedule. It's an inherent part of you. It's not something you do. It's something you are. I suppressed the creative urge as much as possible and plowed ahead, working at the business nonstop. I took a nighttime improv class taught by a local comic, and that worked as a temporary pacifier. But there was a hankering to do something more, on a much greater scale. But how the hell was that going to happen? One Saturday morning, I was listening to Philadelphia Sports Radio WIP 610 AM and had a little idea that just happened to change my entire life. It would build and destroy so much of me over the next decade. Chapter 2. Goodheart. A Saturday morning wrestling program on Philly Sports Radio caught my ear, mostly because that business hadn't been considered mainstream before. I'd loved the sport since I was 9 years old, so naturally I listened to the program with interest, but I also thought I could run some ads on the show. That would be a great opportunity to stick my toe in the business. It was impressive. Pro wrestling get
sample complete. Ready to continue?